Glenn Lowry, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Glenn Lowry, teach economics at Brown University.
John McWhorter, teach linguistics and stuff at Columbia University.
And John, you and I have been video blogging for years now.
Many years.
On various subjects with the facilities of the bloggingheads.television website.
Which and was unimaginable as recently as about 6 or 7 years ago, that's
yep,
right.
Yep, we were part of this cutting edge. And one of our subjects, one of our running recurrent themes that we come back to over and over again is the phenomenon, the person, persona, the political ascendancy of Barack Hussein Obama, our first black president.
Mm-hmm.
Us being black guys, of course, that would be a subject of interest to us, and us being Americans, it's a subject of interest, and so on and so forth. And to introduce our conversation for today, I just wanted to begin by observing what is very clear, which is that the president is in a heap of political trouble. The president is in a critical juncture of his presidency and of his political career. A lot is up for grabs. All kinds of things are being written and said about his failure of leadership or his inadequacy in the office or the extent to which he's disappointed those of us who invested his ascendancy with so much hope. Is he up to the job? There are articles in domestic and foreign newspapers worrying about him, about his handling of these various crises and so forth and so on. And so it falls to us, I think, to assess where he stands, what it means, because we're kind of on the record about this this fellow, Barack Hussein Obama, are we not? We kind of staked out positions, and so I don't know. I don't know where your instincts pointing you these days about President Obama's prospects. How are you feeling about him, about the things that are being written about him? Are you mad at the Tea Party, et cetera, et cetera? Is it somebody else's fault? Has he let us down? Has he let black people down? And I'll stop this long, long introductory soliloquy, but you see where I'm trying to get us going here.
Oh, yeah.
Has he let black people down? Are we on the verge of having the opposite of the pride that we felt with his miraculous victory in 2008 to having the shame that we feel at his ignominious pending defeat, et cetera?
Yeah, well, I don't know if I would say ignominious yet, but I think that it's quite clear that the man's not a fighter. And I think that we assumed that there was a good chance that he was. It's not like he had showed it. There was an experience deficit, but I think we assumed that he was. One reason being that he was something called a community organizer, and we associate that with having your fist up on the left, and we think of Saul Alinsky, etc. And the other reason, I think, is that we thought that, well, he's black and he's concerned with civil rights and he's got a certain strut and he drops his G's, so to speak, sometimes, and so there must be a battler in him. And I think a lot of people thought that, and I think there was a part of me that fell for it too. One hoped. And talk about the audacity of hope. I think at this point we can see that maybe a positive way of putting it, and something that I think a lot of people failed to see in him from the beginning, out of what I think was a sense that a black person must be a hard leftist and a fighter, is that he was always somebody who wanted to split the difference, and I admired him in that. But when it comes to having to split the difference with something like the Tea Party, which I don't think we could have anticipated 3 years ago, he's not a leader, he's not a fighter, he goes with the flow. And I don't see how that's going to change. And as of this debt ceiling deal, and just even the way he went into it, I can see that what happens under him is not going to be revolutionary or exciting. And I'm sad about that, because it's at the point where one does have to admit it. And I'm disappointed. I don't think that he is a failure in the sense that many people talk about. It's still unclear to me precisely what he could have done to create any kind of magic at this point, or even any kind of really serious change, but still he could have done better than this. What do you think?
Okay, he's not a fighter. I just want to parse what you said for a moment. That was a character judgment. That was a statement about what kind of temperament, what kind of, I don't know, fortitude, courage, willingness to engage in, you know, conflict and so forth.
Draw lines.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that, and I'm thinking as I was listening to that, I mean, I agree that he's not doing very well, and I agree that the sort of sense that he got rolled by the conservative Republicans in this debt ceiling extension negotiation, that he got kind of outmaneuvered in the whole politics of the problem of debt and austerity pressures, given that we have a recession, you know, we really need more expansionary policy, we economists tell us, and he's kind of stuck because he can't get political support for the things that need to be done to vigorously fight the recession, which sort of spells his doom.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's getting blamed for this debt, and somehow the debt problem has been allowed to trump the employment problem and the political sensibilities. I agree with Paul Krugman about the relative proportionality, the sort of distorted relative proportionality given to those two problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's kind of been outmaneuvered. So I agree he's not doing very well, and he's headed toward defeat for re-election if the economy doesn't do something, and if he doesn't find his mojo somehow, if he doesn't find a way of using the bully pulpit more effectively. I mean, he's looking very ineffective. The kind of things that were being written about him, not only in the Wall Street Journal, but even in the New York Times and the Washington Post,
mm-hmm.
some of these pieces that I saw are really quite shocking.
The Drew Weston piece in particular.
The Drew Weston piece, but I'm, you know, Peggy Noonan, but Elizabeth Drew, the veteran political reporter,
yes.
Who writes in the Post, had a very sharply critical piece that really struck me a couple of weeks ago, and then there have been others. So he's not doing very well. I agree with all that. But what I want to say is, alongside this character flaw, Obama doesn't have the spine, he's not a fighter thing, one has also, I think, to lay the fact that that something is going on in our politics that I think any Democrat and any liberal Democrat in the presidency would be having a really hard time. Something is going on in our politics in terms of this conservative or Tea Party anti-Washington populist insurgency thing that's happening. I mean, that's the thing that I think, you know, is causing Obama's situation to be so bad, of which his more or less bungled handling of the debt ceiling conflict is a symptom.
Yes.
You know, that election in 2010 really was a setback, and I'm starting to think it was more qualitatively important than even its numerical, you know, quantitative magnitude of however many seats the Republicans took in the House. I don't know the number offhand, but,
mm-hmm.
but even its quantitative magnitude would suggest, because everything is being driven, all the energy, it seems to me, in our national politics. I mean, the closest the Democrats got to it is this Wisconsin, you know, let's save the unions and recall the Republicans thing, which fell
mm-hmm.
short at the end of the day. But the Tea Party and all that stuff that's around that looks to me to be a real force, not just in the South, you know, but broadly across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering, even with a spine, if people say he doesn't have a spine, he doesn't like conflict, even if he liked conflict, you know. I mean, people are always saying, you know, why isn't he Lyndon Johnson, and why aren't the backbenchers afraid of him?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not 1964 anymore, and I don't know that the President of the United States has that much control of. Can he threaten to go and campaign against one of these Tea Party guys in the South Carolina district? Hell no. He dare not show his head in that South Carolina district because
mm-hmm.
they'd have so much trouble controlling the anti-Obama crowds that the president wouldn't allow himself to be there.
Sure.
So I, you know, it just seems to me that, in other words, what I'm saying is the political foundations that he's trying to operate, quite apart from his personal character,
mm-hmm.
the circumstances of this malaise that we're in, this kind of post-crash, you know, the bankers got away with the money and we've got left with the bill
mm-hmm.
feeling that's out there in the country, against which Obama's kind of lofty, we are the ones we've been waiting for rhetoric is absolutely impotent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need a more muscular kind of anti-capitalist, more, you know, kind of rabble-rousing, Huey Long kind of rhetoric,
mm-hmm.
Of which this president is perhaps we should say thankfully, not capable.
I am shocked about that, actually, because it's funny you say Huey Long.
Yeah.
It's a lot of it is certainly things that are beyond his control, and I don't think that the change that we could believe in could happen once there was this Tea Party movement, and Obama didn't create it. But what surprises me is that he isn't somebody who you can imagine saying, and I hate that this FDR comparison is becoming tired, but FDR says, "I welcome their hatred," at a time when people hated him as deeply as many people hate Obama. This is something that doesn't get talked about as much as it should.
He was a class traitor.
There were people who were surmising that he was a Jew, which was very similar to the whole Muslim thing with Obama. And he said, "I welcome their hatred." I don't think Obama does. I think that he's more thin-skinned. You can almost see it in his face that it hurts him that people are talking about him like a dog. And I'm not saying that he's crumpling like a weak person, but he doesn't welcome their hatred, and it's part of that wanting to split the difference. FDR never talked about being somebody who temperamentally enjoyed splitting the difference, partly because he wasn't an intellectual the way Obama is. But I do think that there's a communications problem. Talking about Huey Long, the Obama people should have by now come up with ways of putting things, maybe even somewhat oversimplified, but and maybe manipulative, to counter the kind of rhetoric that the Tea Party people are stimulating their base with, and that never quite seems to happen. It's interesting. My old colleague at Berkeley, George Lakoff, got a lot of attention. It gets to be about 8 or 9 years ago for wanting to reframe the debate by changing the terminology. And a lot of people thought it was a little facile, and frankly, it was, but it wasn't completely off base. And there should be, at this point, at least a reflection of this, which you just don't get in Obama's equivalence of the fireside chats, which you just don't get on his website. You don't have it percolating into the culture. And so you get something like Michelle Bachmann lately, and I think that all of the furore over her is rather theatrical. She has, I mean, not only have we numerically seen at this point after the straw poll that she doesn't have a chance of getting the nomination and certainly not becoming president, but just her husband alone, for about three reasons, would be quite an impossible first man. That alone just makes her a complete...
Oh, you're not going to get off on the Marcus Bachmann thing.
I didn't,
over there with...
Didn't say a thing, but...
Bill Maher and John Stewart.
I'm not gonna get into it, but he'll never be the first spouse. And so that kills
him. Is he not photogenic enough, or is he too effeminate? I'm just trying to understand what you're saying.
I want to get back to what I was saying.
Okay, you can get back to
it.
Never mind Marcus Bachmann. That's okay. I agree. I don't want to talk about that either.
Well, now people are going to see it. It's the fact that whatever his qualities are like, he also has this anti-gay rhetoric. It's hopeless. So, she's not a problem, but I heard...
We should come back to this issue about the anti-gay rhetoric and all that, because I actually have views about that, too.
Yeah, that is an issue. I just meant to say, Michelle Bachmann, I heard a radio clip of her the other day saying, "No constituent has said to me, I want the government to spend money that it doesn't have." Now, that doesn't make any sense. Nobody would come up and say that. But it sounds good. It's got a rhetorical flair. People pick up on it. Obama,
Jesse Jackson can run for president famously in 1984 and 1988.
Both times.
Why can't Michelle Bachmann? Now, I think there's a big mistake that a lot of people, perhaps you too, John, are making. I agree with you about, if you want to say flakiness, or if you want to say creepiness, or whatever you want to say, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever Bill Maher type pejoratives a person might want to invoke against Michelle Bachmann, I'll go along with it, okay? I get it. I understand what they're talking about. Here's the thing. She speaks with passion to a whole lot of Americans who school their children at home,
mm-hmm.
okay? You cannot blow those people off.
Mm-hmm.
Those people have got to be dealt with. They've got to be respected, okay? So when Jesse Jackson ran for president in 1984, 1988, he was the most absurd candidate to be the commander-in-chief of the United States military in charge of the U.S. economy and the United States government. Jesse Jackson? Okay? That was an absurdity. If anyone had dared to discuss his candidacy in those terms, it would have been written out of legitimate discussion in American politics.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people on behalf of whom, the aspirations that they embodied, the thing that he was about, was noble. There mm-hmm. was something decent about it.
Mm-hmm.
And these people out there in Yahooville, in between the coast, okay,
mm-hmm.
are noble.
Mm-hmm.
They're decent. That's a part of America, too. That's mm-hmm. the heartland, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot just blow those people off. You cannot just give them the back of your hand. You're going to have to talk to them about why it is that their views about the preciousness of life mm-hmm. in the fetus
want to be protected in our law or not.
I agree.
You're
going
to have to deal with them about all of their various issues and whatnot. So I say all of that to say I grant you, Michelle Bachmann, President of the United States. Hey, for that matter, this guy Perry from Texas,
mm-hmm.
President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa, that gives me the creeps. But you know, I don't think we can just blow these people off. I guess.
No, and I should say that, for example, I am very much pro-choice, but I do not revile pro-life people. I understand their argument. I consider it an argument that's almost not worth having because we're talking about completely different terms. And in terms of why somebody would go for many of the beliefs of a Michelle Bachmann, I do not look down on the people as benighted. And if I think that there's some information they might be missing, I don't spit on them for not being aware of it. But I'm just talking about the simple aspect of who's going to become president. And it seems to me that Michelle Bachmann is not going to move the center.
I want to go back to Obama for a minute, mm-hmm. in comparison to Huey Long, and I want to say this, and it's a little bit, I step out on a limb a little bit in saying this, a little bit radical, I think, to say it. I think, because I've been thinking about this a lot with respect to houses that are underwater,
mm-hmm.
and the debt overhang problem. So the debt overhang problem is that one reason the economy is dragging,
mm-hmm.
is that people like me don't have any equity in our houses anymore,
because mm-hmm.
the value of our houses have gone down,
mm-hmm.
and the value of our mortgages stayed the same. And I'm not rich anymore like I used to be, and I can't go and refinance that house and get a couple hundred grand in my hands to be able to pay my kids' college tuition or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I'm feeling poor, and there's this debt overhang.
Mm-hmm.
So just very, very simply, okay, the banks hold the mortgage. The house is the collateral. They're owed a fixed value, which is what I have to pay them. The house value is fluctuating along with the market. When the house value goes down, I still have to pay them. Now, I put down a down payment. My down payment could be wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just took the whole hit.
Mm-hmm.
The bank took nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, I put this in simple terms, but it seems to me, the general issue in a kind of financial contraction like what we've had with the housing market down and the unemployment high and interest rates at zero, not being able to stimulate anything and everything, is who's going to take the hit,
mm-hmm.
when you have these write-downs? Whose books are going to reflect the loss of value? Now, my household books are reflecting the loss of value dollar to dollar.
Mm-hmm.
When my house goes down by a dollar, that's a dollar out of my pocket, not out of the bank's pocket, not mm-hmm. 10 cents out of the bank's pocket, not 15 cents out of the bank's pocket. The banks got out of 2008 saved by the American taxpayer. Can't they take part of the hit in 2009, 10, 11, 12 going forward as we try to dig ourselves out of this hole? Can't we renegotiate those contracts, rewrite it, say, okay, so now I do not have a concrete policy proposal to reveal at this time. I'm trying to identify a sentiment,
mm-hmm.
that a political leader,
mm-hmm.
in Huey Long-like spirit,
mm-hmm.
could act on.
Mm-hmm.
2009, 2010 could have been the years,
mm-hmm.
in which masses of people across a lot of different lines got organized around the idea that we were going to get our money back,
mm-hmm.
from those suckers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Not that we were going to have meetings with them in the old office, not that we gave a damn about what they said about us on the Wall Street Journal editorial page. We want our money back.
Mm-hmm.
I think a different, perhaps, temperament, titanium spine, is that what Michelle Bachmann says she got?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody with a titanium spine might have seized an opportunity. I mean, it might have gone very, very much against the president's instincts. I just somehow see that there was a populist, anti-rich banker, we want, you know, you're going to take part of the hit here. We're not just going to bail you out and let you walk.
Mm-hmm.
Man, you're going to take, we're not having a theoretical argument about this. We're making the rules here.
This is interesting.
Yeah. We want our money.
The problem is the we. And this is the classic America problem. It's a huge country. And so when you want to think of yourself as a we, you're thinking of a very abstract thing, even if you're just thinking of Americans. And then if you're talking about people who are underwater, housing-wise, to various extents, the idea that people across the country would think of themselves as a collective entity in that position when we're such a geographically large country and such a diverse country is a tough stretch, even with our modern technology that should bring people together. Now, of course, Obama is not the one who would spearhead this, but I'll bet that he would have been more moved to at least pretend if there had been such a groundswell. It's the sort of thing that makes me... I've been stuck for the past 2 weeks on a glib answer, and I can't seem to come up with one, but I keep circling on this, as to why we're not going to have the kinds of uprisings in the streets among brown-skinned youth that we've seen in London.
Are you sure that we are not? That's interesting.
Viscerally, not intellectually, but I'm thinking, are we really going to have a repeat of, say, 1965, 66, where something starts, you know, for example, the Philadelphia flash mobs with the young boys going around.
Oh, yeah, I've been following that very carefully. You've seen it in Milwaukee and, you know,
and it seems to be spreading, jumping on mostly white people. Is that going to come to be something happening also in Oakland and Seattle and Dallas?
We better pray not.
And, you know, I don't feel it coming. And I'm open to saying this here and then next week, America burning. But it seems that that's unlikely here, partly because all those people in those different cities, even the black ones who are part of the black community, they don't feel like they're enough of an us with enough of a single goal of animus to rise up together. And, you know, if they did, I think they would have by now. We're in the middle of the summer. We have terrible problems. Yet, I think it's just going to be what it was, little conflagrations, as opposed to London, where it's one city, and a group of people rise up, and they stay risen up. Do you feel that we're in danger of that kind of rising?
I've been following Walter Russell Mead's post at the American Interest on this, and we should put up some links to some of his posts.
Yeah. Which I don't like.
Great interest as he speculates about what the effects could be in terms of possible civil disturbances in our cities of this thing that we've entered into now, which is going to be a long period of retrenchment and constraint with respect to social policy. And he's also seeing trends in the larger sort of economy and society. The rise of the Latinos and so forth in metropolitan areas around the country, the decline of public employment and of public employee unions where blacks are overrepresented, the diminished prospects of the big bureaucratic sort of manufacturing concerns like the auto plants and steel makers and all of this in the global economy of the 21st century, which are places where sort of formal civil rights and law enforcement might take place. And much more of a kind of fast-moving entrepreneurial, smaller business sector, which is where the job growth is going to take place, this is him speculating, but which are outside the reach of the Civil Rights Act and rely more on informal social networks of you know, people's contacts to hire, and so blacks would be disadvantaged.
Right.
He sees the black middle class being squeezed by these developments, and that perhaps undermining a kind of arrangement of relative social stability that we've had in the post-1970s period in our cities, with the exception of Los Angeles, famously 1992, but where we haven't had these kind of problems because there has been, A, enough opportunity for the black middle class and enough openings for people to aspire to move up, and B, a crackdown in terms of tough-on-crime law enforcement and policing in the cities and the expansion of the prison populations to deal with the unruly black element. This is Walter Russell Mead. I'm paraphrasing him. So now, having said all of that, I just wanted to give that as a background. I followed these posts of his and these musings of his with interest. And I think...
Glenn, very quickly, did you also read the comments, which were some of the most interesting I've ever read?
No, I didn't read the... On the last one I sent you...
They are an essay...
I didn't read where he takes off from the London riots and says this could be coming to us.
100 comments.
I have to look at the... do you want to say something?
Spectacular. Actually, I've never seen... I want to get right back to what you were saying.
Yeah.
The comments of this article contain some of the most open, bitter impatience with black grievance that I have had occasion to pour through in
years.
Well,
I got to look at it. I haven't, but I'm not...
And also, the people are not idiots, so it's not a bunch of people who identify as racist.
It's not Yahoo's racists who are just venting. These are people.
It's a national mood. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, this is kind of where I was trying to get to, this national mood thing. It's very striking to me in observing the reaction of the British establishment to these disturbances in London and other British cities. That you know, of insisting on a values orientation. You know, these people are wicked. They're bad. Their parents ought to have raised them better, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And much less so on a kind of sociology of, you know, complex causality where these individuals are manifesting. I mean, you've heard a little bit of this, you know, discontent with larger political trends, the hopelessness.
Root causes, right.
Et cetera, et cetera. And a law and order crackdown, flooding the streets with police, and let's search through all of the surveillance cameras that we can, and we're going to knock some doors open and go find some people and drag them in front of the court and make sure that they're punched. Okay. Now, I think if we were to have anything like, anything that was even an inkling of the 1960s in these cities, anything that went in that direction to the degree, the United States response would be these two things that I've identified, which is a moral condemnation and an attribution of it to the wickedness and the spiritual deprivation of the people who are involved.
You are correct.
And also a very stern hand. I mean, a smackdown. Okay? So
I don't know about that.
We better pray that it doesn't happen, because there's not going to be any Kerner Commission reports.
That wouldn't happen
again. You know, there are no Mayor Lindsay's out there. You know what I'm saying? I'm talking about the New York of the 1960s, 1970s. It would be a smackdown, Giuliani-esque, and it would have 70% support.
You know what would spark that in terms of looking at it? You know, the truth is, this is just an accident. Watts was actually this week in 1965. I believe Watts was August 11th, 1965, and here we are on August, what is it? I never know exactly what date it is. Is it the 16th or something?
I think today is the 15th.
So this is the week. And that was stimulated by a police altercation. Yeah, a police altercation. And the closest thing we've had to it since was Rodney King. That's the police again. And if anything, we notice that these days, the relationship between black men and the police is far from perfect. But the days when something like Amadou Diallo was pretty much normal, that was 1999, I think, or 8. And so that was a long time ago, and because of the outcry, and as strange as I feel saying it, a lot of the outcry and a lot of its effectiveness had to do with none other than Reverend Al Sharpton. It's people like him who did have an advantage in cases like this. We don't see as much of that sort of errant misabuse of police power. And with Diallo, they didn't shoot him down in cold blood. It was bad training, but still. That sort of thing happens less. And so with Oscar Grant in San Francisco a couple of years ago, for example, a boy was pushed down.
I want to be careful with the anecdotes, John. I don't know the facts.
Oh, I was just going
to
say,
I'm not arguing with you. I'm just saying I'd prefer to have, you know, like a census of, you know, police shootings and circumstances of questionable,
ultimately,
you know, and to know whether those numbers have gone up, down, or sideways over the last 10, 20 years in a dozen and two dozen American cities.
I just
don't know those facts.
We don't, but I think a reasonable overview is that the ones that are as stark as Diallo are less. And the reason I'm saying that is because it seems that to the extent that that's true, it's less likely that there would be this kind of uprising, because that's what tends to stimulate it, rather than these more abstract, although grievous, economic issues. I don't think that people are going to rise up in the streets because there aren't as many service jobs or because there aren't as many government jobs. It has to be something more concrete than that. And that doesn't mean that we don't have serious problems, but that's a lot of why I'm not worried about London becoming the United States. There has to be a stimulus for that that really hits people in their guts.
Well, let me ask you that. I just don't know how you know these things. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just less certain. I'm less secure. Because what was up that? This is just totally off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
Social networking, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's going to the various websites and various servers, and they're exchanging messages with each other, and they're coordinating, okay? And we see this in the Arab Spring, and we see this in the Let's Get Together and Loot the Store in London, and we also see it in Let's Get Together and Beat Up White People on the Avenue in Philadelphia.
Right.
What's to stop a bunch of ex-cons who have been radicalized by Islam? Let me just paint this picture. You know, I'm going to write the novel. You know, this is going to be the plot. From coordinating their activities across a dozen or two dozen American cities, and I don't know what, creating incidents, stirring up some, you know, fostering some kind, you know, suppose they think that the system is bankrupt. Suppose they feel that, you know, suppose Rick Perry does get elected president of the United States, and that the, you know, I mean, you know, you can invent your own scenario. But I don't see how you're going to see something like this coming. It seems to me that this, it's not going to be driven by the slow accretion of grievance and protest against the whatever. It's going to be a spark that's going to seem to come out of nowhere, but that will be a match put to dry tinder, and there's plenty of dry tinder lying around.
You know, I would venture to... Let's see who turns out to be right. The dry tinder would have to involve the police killing or beating someone up in a starkly unjustified way. That does happen. And then even though we have the social media, I wonder if you could make people in Oakland feel as immediately aggrieved as people in Philadelphia, say, might feel if the incident happened in Philadelphia, such that you would have a nationwide conflagration. And maybe you could, but it seems to me that to the extent that something like that doesn't happen as much lately, we might be lucky and the flash mobs might be as far as it's going to go at this point. But I'm open to being proven wrong. You know, you don't know when these things are coming.
Let me take up another subject with you. It's a related subject, John. So a lot of people are saying the following about the London and England disturbances,
mm-hmm,
and whatnot, which have involved, oh, by the way, a racial element,
sure,
to some degree. You know, I mean, it's been difficult to attract people to talk about. And I don't really have a point to make about it, except that I find it really very interesting. But a lot of people are saying the following. They're saying, look, this is the failure of the nanny state. This is the failure of liberalism in some broader sense.
Mm-hmm.
This is a multicultural relativism. In the case of Britain, will involve something about how you handle immigration and assimilation and the extent to which you insist that people, quote, become British, close quote. In the case of the United States, it would have a different inflection, but the general idea would be a set of ideas associated with quote-unquote progressive thinking centered in universities and in the left political parties, and then creeping into law and bureaucratic policy practice through a variety of guises, how you treat criminals, how you educate children, whether or not you insist on standards with things like affirmative action, whether or not you call a spade, unquote, with respect to things like political correctness.
Mm-hmm.
And that this whole intellectual framework, high tax, big government, if you wanted to broaden this critique to include the economic factors, but certainly the cultural factors, the issues about assimilation and immigration, the issues about education, about relativism and about, you know, tolerance and all these kind of things, that somehow what we're seeing disorder in Britain,
mm-hmm,
is a manifestation of the kind of unraveling of that,
mm-hmm,
of that view, that sort of stance. And it's something much closer to the Manhattan Institute's,
mm-hmm,
view of the world than to, I don't know what, the Brookings Institute, or maybe what's the opposite of the Manhattan Institute?
Call it Brookings, yeah.
Is right.
Mm-hmm.
Something much closer to the City Journal, mm-hmm, sensibility of what do you say when people act out in public, and you know, what's the root sources of our apparent social failures in terms of large numbers on welfare or large numbers on prison. Much closer to that than the left wing,
sure,
view is correct. So I'm wondering how you react to those musings.
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, I think that the whole country, this is going to sound like I'm shilling for my former employer, and it's what I really believe. The whole country has moved in the direction of the Manhattan Institute when it comes to issues of how to make poor black people's lives better, and what the response is when poor black people may have a tendency to respond in ways that other parts of the country wouldn't approve of. And so, for example, yeah, the whole broken windows phenomenon, the idea of people being, you know, arrested and then looking at their previous record, and the idea being that quite simply having it hard can't be seen as an excuse for bad behavior. That can be taken way too far. But I think that the general mood, and it's partly this comment section that I was reading to Walter Russell Mead's article, that seems to be more of a national feeling. And you know something, Glenn, to tell you the truth, I completely understand root causes. I can put myself in the head of somebody who's running through the streets and rioting because that's what everybody else is doing, because they have a resentment against society. I can see that, and I don't think of that person as evil. But then on the other hand, you have Philadelphia's mayor, Michael Nutter, black for the record, and one line that he gives, and you can call this boilerplate, but I think it's rather inescapable in terms of actual human feeling in a society as, you know, maybe Rousseau would have conceived of it, which is that I don't care what kind of economics you've grown up under, that doesn't give you a justification for going out and beating people up. And you know, at the end of the day, we can have seminars, we can talk about Brookings versus the Manhattan Institute. We're never going to get past that. Now, does that mean that if there were these riots, that heads would be cracked in a way that people are complaining they're not being in London? I'm not sure about that. I'm trying to get my head wrapped around a justification for thinking that suddenly there would be blood in the streets and that nobody would remotely tolerate it. It hasn't happened with the flash mobs, for example.
Well, I take Michael Nutter, mayor of Philadelphia's forceful, I mean, the speech of his that was linked to by Rich Lowry, mm-hmm. I think it was, at the National Review Online, mm-hmm. Being held up as a, you know, exemplary illustration of moral fortitude. Mm-hmm. So Nutter speaking to in a church, an African American church, to an African American audience, very, very forcefully denounces and castigates the unruly youths.
It was his church, by the way.
Was it indeed? Okay. Mm-hmm. At the unruly youths who are, you know, roaming streets in Philadelphia and attacking white people.
Mm-hmm.
In the name of whatever they, you know, but they just so openly attack, and obviously he cannot have that. I mean, that's the first order problem, mm-hmm. For the chief executive of the city is to forcefully react to that. So obviously he can't have that as mayor, but he also spoke from his heart as a Christian, as an African American. These people were a disgrace to their race. He intimated their parents should be ashamed of themselves. Where are their parents? Their parents. You know, when I was growing up, my mother had a rule that I had to be this nutter be in by a certain hour, and where are the parents?
Mm-hmm.
All of which is true. I find that I was really struck by the forcefulness of it. And I mean, he'd crack heads if he had to. Yeah. I don't think Nutter would hesitate to deploy the restraining forces that would be necessary to deal with. If he had a broader problem of civil disturbance in the city, he would respond to it with force. I believe, and would be supported by 70% of the residents of Philadelphia in doing so.
But not the op-ed pages beyond the nominally conservative ones, I think we'd assume.
Well, maybe not, and maybe not by me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted to say that I wanted to push back a little bit. I was just playing the devil's advocate by saying I thought that all of this stuff was a proof of the Manhattan Institute's basic virtue and its posture on public policy debates. I want to advocate the idea that there is collective responsibility even in the wrongful acts of individual persons. I want to say that if you create conditions in your society and allow them to persist that marginalize and dehumanize people, then it is to be expected, not necessarily to be deplored,
mm-hmm.
That those people will act out in ways that are inconsistent with the maintenance of civility and peace. And perhaps if there is no justice, there ought not to be any peace, I would even be so far willing to go so far as to say. I mean, for example, mass incarceration, quote-unquote, which is just to say the mobilization of resources within our domestic society to control people physically with police and prisons. It's a huge development in the post-1970s America. It has a profound racial element in it. I believe it's legitimate politics to stand back from the society and say, what have we wrought here? And then to say about it, perhaps it needs to be protested and resisted. Not just debated,
mm-hmm.
okay? Shut down the traffic on the bridge. Go on a hunger strike en masse on the Supermax prison. Nullify as jurors proceedings of law that otherwise would be one more implementation of what you regard to be an unjust system. Felony disenfranchisement.
Mm-hmm.
Where African American men in the millions are not permitted to participate in the franchise even after they've served their time and been released from prison.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I could see a person saying American democracy is illegitimate because of that.
I can too.
Okay? And therefore converting that into action. So when a guy like Cornel West or Tavis Smiley say, we're going to go out there and do a poverty tour and whatnot, everybody snickers and says, ha ha ha. I don't necessarily laugh that off, even though I don't have any great hopes that West and Smiley are going to do it. But I in a way appreciate their effort, because it may be that it's the mistake about a guy like Obama is to think electing a smooth talker to the White House actually changes something.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the things don't change until you have Tea Party scale mobilization of people who are prepared to talk crazy in front of the camera if necessary because they deeply believe that something is wrong in America. I, for my part, deeply believe that something is wrong in America.
Glenn, I do too, but and there are so many places we could go there that we could go another hour, but I want to try just this.
Talk about, you get the last word.
Talk about the Manhattan Institute.
Yeah.
This is the question. All of what you said, I completely agree with. There is a serious problem, the incarceration, the ideally that there would be group protests of an articulate nature, but let's take the reality and the question of what we do more on the ground level. And this requires going a place that I'm probably going to take a lot of heat for, but this is necessary. Talk about one of these flash mobbers. I'm going to make one of them up, and people are going to say I'm stereotyping, but I'm not. I'm trying to engage with a real factor. Let's call him Deshaun. His name really might be Deshaun. And you stop Deshaun somewhere on Broad Street. He's on his way downtown to do what these flash mobs do. And I can picture Deshaun, because I grew up in Philadelphia. I know what train he rides to go do this. And you say, Deshaun, come here. Deshaun, what are you doing? What are you going to do? And what Deshaun would say is, you know, I'm going to go fuck me up some white people.
Exactly.
Now, he would not say, I am going to harass. That's how he talks. I'm going to go fuck me up some white people, man.
Right.
And he thinks it's funny. Now, that's all he knows. He doesn't know. He only has a vague sense of the percentages of people who are incarcerated, etc.
Oh, I see. He's not a political actor. He's just Deshaun going to fuck up some white people.
Yeah, let's call him Deshaun Gordon. And he's just stuck in this. Now, what do you do with him? Now, do you crack his head against the pavement and make him bleed? I wouldn't, no. But on the other hand, does Deshaun just get a smack on the hand because he's a victim of circumstances beyond his control? That's what America is beginning to have trouble with. Because, and you know, Glenn, honestly, I think,
sure.
And I've already written on this, I think that the reason those guys would be getting on the train and going downtown and messing with white people, I think it's because of the police. I think, why would they be that concretely angry at white people in 2011? The reason is because most of the white people they encounter are the police who are in their housing projects, trawling for drugs and sometimes finding them. And so I think that, as with everything at this point, it's at the point where, to me, everything traces to the war on drugs.
John, this evidence-free speculation about what these people are thinking is unsettling me. I think we need to ask them. I mean, I mean that in a, quote, scientific way. I mean, mm-hmm. I think we need... I don't trust your instincts. I have no idea what's driving them. I don't know if it's hip-hop that's driving them. I don't know if it's what they're watching on television or what they're reading in the newspapers that's driving them. I have no clue,
Glenn,
what their life is.
I have to say that I am basing this not on just watching him walk down the street. I have attended... Now, I have not done a survey. I've attended two sessions in this city, in New York, actually, across the Hudson, that are meetings between the cops and local kids. Where
that's two more than I've been.
Where the kids are asked, so what's bothering you?
Yeah.
Why did you do that? And I have heard exactly two, this is what really touched me, two 14 or 15-year-old black kids say, I'm tired of the cops bothering me. And they
well,
don't...
Well, New York is a, you know, that stop and frisk thing in New York is horrible, man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let me just tell you, and I know you know this because I must have related the story in private conversation. I was stopped by New York City police officers for riding my bicycle on the sidewalk within 50 yards of my front door.
Oh, I think you told me this. That's right.
Coming out of an apartment in Harlem in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't believe they're stopping kids on the Upper West Side.
Rather seldom.
Or the Upper East Side in New York City. But a couple of miles away in Harlem, just north of Central Park,
mm-hmm.
a 60-year-old man going to his university office was detained by police officers because, quote, he had violated the ordinance of riding his bicycle on the sidewalk. I didn't know such ordinance existed. All I was doing was going to the curb at the corner.
Mm-hmm.
They detained me and gave me a citation.
Can't have that.
Now, that just infuriated me.
It should have. I think.
And I can't imagine what a kid who actually has to be rousted all the time by
these
people is going to be thinking. So the statistics on stop and frisk in New York and on the extent to which they are unequally applied in the different neighborhoods,
mm-hmm.
and the black and Hispanic kids are being harassed, I mean, that might account for what they're saying in some of these meetings.
And if you look at the Philly op-ed pages, you'll find that often they say, in response to things like this, in the Inquirer and the Philly Daily News, that it's not that different in cities like Philadelphia, although there is a special problem in New York. So I'm getting it from that. And it makes me sick. And that's one of the reasons I wouldn't want poor Deshaun to get beaten up, because there is a reason. It's still not justifiable, but there's a societal problem that we need to address. Now, what Obama is going to do about that, to bring this around, it seems that sort of thing is only going to be indirect. And so community college, but then he seems to have pulled back on that particular deal, the idea being to make it easier to get a vocational degree. That struck me as very pro-black and pro-working class black, and that's not working out as well.
We ought to do solutions in another conversation.
Yeah, because I think that there are some. I don't know if there are going to be any, but there are solutions that we could talk about.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we're in a bad way, Glenn. We are. I agree with you. I cannot paint any of this with, I've just run my metaphor into the ground, but none of this can be sugar-coated. There is a major disappointment that has happened. I'm loath to term Obama a Jimmy Carter at this point, but it's being done. And I would say that things are not spectacular. And are we going to worry that this is somebody who makes black people look bad? At this point, I don't see anything black in what he hasn't done. I see him as just a person. I've always tried to see him as just a person to an extent, although we've always also seen him as a symbol.
Well, my worry about him making black people look bad is that he'll take the sort of moral authority of black people's struggle and somehow wrap himself in that to some degree. Now, I'm not accusing him of doing this. I mean, people did it on his behalf during the campaign.
But you think he might do it now?
And he encouraged it. I'm not saying I think. I say that would be the thing that would worry me. In other words, black people haven't got a collective reputational investment in Barack Obama. I mean, he doesn't shame us.
No.
If he were to not get reelected, why should we feel? That seems silly.
Jimmy Carter didn't shame white people or Southerners.
Exactly. Yeah. So like that. But that somehow the to the extent that his suppose he plays the race card. Okay, if people are playing the race card on his behalf all the time. Mm-hmm. Oh man, if he weren't black, he wouldn't be doing this. If he weren't black, he wouldn't be doing this. Well, I don't much like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do I think there are racists out there who don't like Obama because he's black? Of course, I know that there are. And there would be people like that. There are going to be people who are not going to like Mitt Romney if he would become president because he's a Mormon, or John F. Kennedy because he was a Catholic, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Nixon because he was, you know, a neurotic.
Because he was strange. Right.
Sure, there are racists out there. But I very much dislike the appropriation of the broader kind of racial argument in America. Have we done right by the historical legacy that we inherit out of slavery, and is the country still challenged to make major? I very much like having that assimilated to Obama's personal political career aspirations or whatever. I didn't like that he invoked Martin Luther King Jr. when he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo
mm-hmm.
in 2009. I very much disliked that that maneuver
mm-hmm.
On his part there, and I could, you know, in another conversation say more about that, but that would be my concern of black people being damaged by Obama's potential failure, not that we're going to all feel bad because a black person
mm-hmm.
Didn't get reelected president.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll
Let's
see.
Let's keep it going, Glenn.
We will indeed, John. I enjoy talking to you.
You too. Soon.
Bye.
Bye.